of life. The problem comes up over and over again. And it comes up vis-a-vis religion as well. The person claims to know something. He says he knows something. The challenge will be, how do you know? So he's supposed to provide the reason. Some kind of reason for his knowing. How good does the reason have to be? The reason will be some kind of evidence or some kind of proof or some kind of argument. How good does it have to be? When can we say, and because I have this kind of reason, I really know? Now, there's an answer to this question, which is short, simple, clear, precise, direct, and raw. That answer is, you know when the reason you give proves you're right beyond any possibility of mistake. You have to give a reason that proves that you're right beyond any possibility of mistake. If you give such a reason, you know. If you don't give such a reason, or you can't give such a reason, then you don't know. Well, I think you can see already that it's clear, short, precise, direct. Why do I say that it's wrong? Because if that's the standard, then it turns out that we don't know anything. And any standard that tells us that we don't know anything seems as a pointless standard. Why do I say that we don't know anything? Well, let's try. Let's try some examples of things that I think we all feel confident about. We'd all say that we know. And let's see if we can give a reason that proves absolutely that we're right without the possibility of mistake. Let's take, do you know who your parents are? Uh-huh. How do you know? Because they told you. And you trusted them. Isn't it possible that you were adopted? Are you telling me that you look like your parents? That's because they took their baby pictures with them to the orphanage. And they looked for a baby that looks like their baby pictures. That's why you look like them. Are you telling me you did a DNA check? Well, first of all, you didn't. I know. And second of all, even if you did, how could you be sure that your parents, well, those people, you know, the ones who say that they're your parents, how can you be sure they didn't pay off the workers to give you a false result? How could you have a proof of a certainty that they are your parents without the possibility of going wrong? The truth is, you can't. Well, let's see. What are the candidates? I'm sitting in front of a table. Well, Descartes said, how could you prove beyond the possibility of a mistake that you're not dreaming right now? In which case, you're not sitting in front of a table. The only dream is you're sitting in front of a table. And you wake up 3 minutes in bed. Well, you say, at least I know that I exist. You do. I want you to know there are people who have doubted it. There are people who have doubted that there is any such thing as an I. Descartes' infamous, I think, therefore I am. Surely I'm thinking, because if I try to doubt that I'm thinking, the doubting is more thinking. So you can't doubt what you're thinking. And if you're thinking, you must exist, right? No. Maybe I think is a mistake. Maybe it's a mistake to think that there's an I doing thinking. Like I swim or I walk. Let's take a parallel. This objection was actually made in Descartes' time. Let's take a parallel. In English we say, it's raining. What is the it that's doing the raining? It's raining. Subject, predicate. So you say, don't be silly, you know, it's raining. There's no it. I mean, I don't mean that there's an it doing the raining. What I mean is there are raindrops falling, that's all. Don't take the it so seriously. Don't take the subject predicate so seriously. The fact is that the subject predicate in the sentence structure doesn't mean there has to be a thing doing the action. Aha. Uh-huh. So when there's a subject predicate in the sentence, it doesn't mean there's a thing doing the action. Well, what about I think? Maybe we should better say there's thinking going on. There's thinking going on. There's thought after thought after thought after thought. Right? But there's no I doing the thinking. They're just thoughts. Indeed, that's what David Hume actually wrote in his philosophy. He wrote a book, a treatise on human nature. This is what he writes. I don't know, maybe he meant it as a joke, but he gets to the end of the entire book, 350 pages. And he writes a postscript. And in the postscript he says, I see that I have finished a book on human nature, and nowhere in the book have I mentioned the self. What an interesting moment. I just sort of caught it on the way to the publisher, you know, to the printer. I just noticed in the galleys that there's no self here. So I set myself to find the self. You know, I'm sort of looking inside to find it. And I find that whenever I look, what I find are colors and sounds and feels and tastes and aromas. But I don't find any self in addition to all those things. And so he says, I'm inclined to either think that there is no self, which is a kind of shocking and embarrassing discovery, or maybe I made a mistake somewhere and I don't know where it is. That's where he sort of ends his book. So even the existence of the self is not to be taken for granted. My field of research was philosophy and mathematics. Even in mathematics and even in logic, there are disagreements. So the problem here is to use that standard of reason. The reason has to be a proof, something that proves I'm right, of a certainty without the possibility of mistake. If we use that standard, it turns out that we don't know anything. Yeah.
These questions that are being brought up are questions that no one really asks because it's axiomatic that either this exists or this happens, and so there's no need to look into it if it's axiomatic. Everyone agrees without looking into it.
Well, perhaps what you say is true, but I don't see exactly how it bears on what on the subject I'm focusing on. My subject is, when is it appropriate to say that you know? It can't just be that everybody agrees on it's appropriate to say that you know. There can be universal prejudices, right? So that can't quite be the criterion of when it's appropriate to say that you know. I was just discussing Descartes' criterion. Descartes' criterion is hopeless. Because it comes out that you don't know anything. Let's just take a minute to explain why this makes it hopeless. Suppose someone says, there was actually one philosopher who did this, said, no, why do they make it hopeless? It is the right criterion. And what we have discovered is that we don't know anything. Right? That's it. You know, just bite the bullet. It's pretty shocking, I guess, but there it is. You don't know anything. There's a problem in logic here, which G.E. Moore pointed out over 100 years ago. I suppose people in history of philosophy will say it was pointed out long before that. Whenever you make an argument, you have premises and then you reason to a conclusion. An argument doesn't automatically prove that a conclusion is true. Even a valid argument doesn't automatically prove that a conclusion is true. All the argument does is set up a tug of war. A tug of war between the premises and the opposite of the conclusion. And it's not clear who should win. Sometimes, when you hear an argument, you feel forced to accept the conclusion. Sometimes, when you hear an argument, you feel forced to reject the premises. Here are two simple examples. Socrates is a man. All men are mortal, therefore Socrates is mortal. Yeah, I guess so. And I think we're all inclined to accept the conclusion that Socrates is mortal. Maybe because we knew it already for the argument? Okay, let's not raise that possibility. Now here's another argument. Socrates is an angel. All angels are immortal. Therefore, Socrates is immortal. Ha! Not going along with that one. Why not? Because Socrates is dead! Then if he's dead, he can't be immortal. So, that no, for sure, that the conclusion is not true. No, if the conclusion is not true, and the argument's valid, then something's wrong with the premises. Can you guess which one? Yeah, Socrates is an angel. That's clearly the wrong premise. You have an argument, a valid argument, that doesn't say you have to accept the conclusion. What you do is ask yourself, how strong are the premises, and how outrageous is the conclusion? And if the conclusion is too outrageous, then the right thing to do is to say something's got to be wrong with the premises. Not to bite the bullet, swallow the medicine, and accept the conclusion anyway, but to bet on there being something wrong with the premises, even if you don't know what's wrong. Even if you can't point out what's wrong. Now, we went through this some time ago with Zeno's paradoxes. Zeno had arguments that nothing moves. Very clever arguments. For 2,300 years, nobody could point out exactly what was wrong with the arguments. And the conclusion of all the arguments was nothing moves. So what did people do? Bite the bullet and accept the conclusion? No, they did not. What they said is, the conclusion is outrageous. Of course things are moving. There's got to be something wrong with the premises. So don't be cowed by an argument. Ask yourself, what's stronger? The premises, which would force me to accept the conclusion, or that the conclusion is outrageous, which should force me to reject the premises? Very often in philosophy, what you get is this. You get an argument where the conclusion contradicts something that you know very well to be true. I mean, your common sense tells it to be true, and everybody agrees it's true. It's obvious that it's true. And the premises are persuasive, and they're somewhat intuitive. And you don't exactly know what's wrong with them. It's hard to point out where there might be a failure. And the philosopher says, well then, you know, you have to accept the fact that nothing exists. What? Yeah, you can't accept it because look, you know, I proved it. At this point, it's appropriate to ask, what's more convincing to me? Your philosophy? Or that this is the table? Seems to me I'm much more certain of the fact that this is a table than I am that your philosophy is correct. If so, then your philosophy should not convince me that there are no tables. It shouldn't convince me. All you've done is taken your philosophy as a starting point and given me an argument to the conclusion that there are no tables. As long as your philosophy is less certain to me than that there are tables, the right move for me to make is to reject your philosophy, even if I can't point out what's wrong with it. Now, G. Moore was considering people who had what they thought of as proofs that there isn't any external physical world. And he used to refute them like this. He said, this is a hand. And this is a hand. And hands are physical objects, so they're physical objects, therefore you're wrong. So they all yelled up and down. What do you mean? You're just begging, the question. We won't admit that this is a hand. You're just assuming this is a hand. Well, gee, Moore wasn't stupid. I mean, he was a professor at Cambridge, right? What he was saying is, you have your philosophy. And your philosophy leads to the conclusion there are no physical objects. What am I more certain of? Your philosophy or that I have hands? I'm clearly more certain that I have hands than of your philosophy. Then the right thing for me to do is reject your philosophy. So, somebody says, look, I have a philosophy about knowledge. Here's what I say knowledge is. Knowledge is something which you've got to support with a reason that proves you're right, of a certainty, without any possibility of mistake. That's his philosophy. That's his philosophy about knowledge. Okay, very good. It's a philosophy. Now the conclusion is, nobody knows anything. Gosh, you know, if I ask myself, what am I more sure of? That some people know something somewhere? Or that his philosophy is right? I think I'm more certain that some people know something somewhere than I am that his philosophy is right. The correct move is to say, you've got to be making a mistake in analyzing knowledge. After all, your analysis of knowledge is only a piece of philosophy. How obvious is that? How solid is that? How convincing is that? It's intuitive. That's all. Therefore, the whole of philosophy has rejected Descartes. Maybe the whole minus one or two. And everybody's busily searching for the right definition of knowledge. Nobody's willing to buy the conclusion that nobody knows anything. Unfortunately, for the last 350 years, nobody's found the right solution. It's an industry. New books come out on this all the time. And there are famous objections and difficulties and different conceptions of what the project is about. It's philosophy. It's a mess. But one thing they're all agreed upon is, we're not going back to Descartes, we're not going to take seriously the idea that we don't know anything. So, I give you this introduction because here's the game that is played over and over again with respect to religion, Torah in particular, and other things when people want to play the game. You say, you know there's a God. Well, let's see your reason. So you give a reason, or two, or three, and the critic says, listen, watch, I'll show you that even if your reason is correct, it's still possible that you're wrong. It's still possible that there is no God. So the defender gets nervous, and he tries to squeeze out of it. No, it's not possible. Look, I'll show you. And the critic very cleverly points out that no matter how you pile on the evidence, still it's possible that you're making a mistake. And when the defender finally gives up and says, well, I guess you're right, it is possible I'm wrong, the critic says, well, see, then you don't know. The whole game is a mistake. The rules are invalid. What the defender should have said when he's challenged by the critic, what he should have said is this, you're right. It is possible that I'm wrong. So what? So what? That doesn't mean I don't know. Just because it's possible that I'm wrong, that doesn't defeat saying that I know. You don't have to have a proof of a certainty that you're right without the possibility of being wrong to know. I can't tell you exactly what you mean because nobody can do that. Nobody's got a solution to the philosophical problem. But just pointing out that it's possible that I'm wrong is trivial and irrelevant. And notice that you wouldn't take it seriously in any other area of life as well. With this, I'm making a bridge to another application of the general idea. Somebody said to you, where do you live? And you recite your address. Simpson. Have you ever heard of people who have delusions? Of course you have. You know, you've heard of people who think they're Napoleon. 100 people, easy for them, is sure that he and only he is Napoleon. Right. There's certain people who have delusions. Can you prove to yourself or anyone else that right now you don't have a delusion about where you live? I mean, maybe you'll go there tonight and there'll be other people there and they'll say, why are you coming here? I said, because I live here. They say, no, you don't. I mean, look here. You know, this is our house, not your house. What could you do right here and now to prove of a certainty that you're not suffering from a delusion about where you live?
You can show that delusions are quite transient and that they will eventually die. All the time, rather. They will always die. After that. When I say die, I mean like they will end, like always end.
How could you show that?
Going around and just finding all these delusional people. And, you know. Oh, wait, hallucination or delusional people?
Either one.
Oh, because it's...
Delusion. I mean, delusion is typically don't die. People will think they're Napoleon. You can go on like that for decades.
Oh, yeah. Okay, I was thinking of hallucination.
Oh, you think hallucination? Oh, no, that's delusion. And even if I said hallucination, all you'd be able to show me is that other people's hallucinations come to an end quickly. Does that prove beyond the possibility of mistake that your hallucination is going to come to an end quickly? Prove beyond the possibility of mistake? Surely not. No.
But there could be a way of high probability that it is true.
What's that?
There might be a way of high probability that...
Oh, I'm coming to that. But what I'm pointing out is that nobody takes this seriously anywhere else in life. They say, oh my gosh, you know, it's true, it's possible that I'm suffering from a delusion. So what? So I'll check into a hotel and I won't go home that night? Because other people might be there? It's ridiculous. No one will take that seriously for a moment. Of course I know where I live. Now, I want to use this as a bridge to another subject, which is related and it has its own intrinsic interest. You know, there are people who deny the Holocaust. One gambit that they use is to say, consider all the evidence of the Holocaust. Where does it come from? It comes largely from people who were under terrible, terrible stress, who were physically malnourished and mistreated. Can you really trust the testimony of people in that condition? You'll tell me that you have the records of Jewish populations in Europe, which are now missing. You have records in Poland? Please, give me a break. Poland? You might just as well be talking about the Middle Ages. Poland between the wars. And we know that some Jews escaped to South America. Who told you that a million Jews didn't go to South America? And the Germans admitted it? Well, listen, the Germans lost the war, so what good would have been them to deny it? When they lose a war, you're not in a position to deny anything. The truth is, of course, it's gigantically exaggerated. Lots of people died in the war. 20 million Russians died in the war. 20 million. And lots of Poles died. Yeah, some Jews died in the war. Gypsies died in the war. Lots of people died in the war. But a systematic attempt to exterminate. It's just, the evidence is not good. Now, if you respond to this by pouring on more evidence, more witnesses and more survivors, well, we still have survivors, more eyewitness accounts and more, the answer will be the same. The people are unreliable, the records are unreliable, so on and so on. There is a way to respond. This I heard from California, who has a radio program. Guy puts out Dennis Prager. Dennis Prager makes lots of mistakes, and he's not an authority on anything. And he has a couple of clever moves, but the fact that I'm quoting him shouldn't be interpreted anywhere as an endorsement. But his move here, I think, is the right move. What he says is, don't try to attack such a person from the outside. Don't bring more and more external evidence, because he has the same defense against all of it. No, attack him from the inside. Attack his consistency. Ask him, you don't believe in the Holocaust. There's mountains and mountains of evidence, but you think it's all exaggerated, unreliable, and all the rest. Let's see. Do you believe in the American Civil War? Do you believe that there were men on the moon? Do you believe in the winner of the last Super Bowl? Well, especially if this is happening in public, these are very good questions to ask. Because if he says no, he doesn't believe there was an American Civil War, he doesn't believe that men walked to the moon, he doesn't believe in the last Super Bowl, so then he's just beyond belief, you know, he's beyond discussion, no one's going to take him seriously. But if he does believe in those things, ask him, how is it? Do you really have superior evidence for the American Civil War than you do for the Holocaust? Is superior evidence for Neil Armstrong and others walking on the moon? Or the last Super Bowl than the Holocaust? What kind of evidence do you have? American Civil War took place 140 years ago. Physical evidence, we have some statues, some books that were written. Far less books were written at the time about the Civil War than were written at the time about the Holocaust. Today you have actual survivors of the Holocaust you can talk to. You know, survivors of the Civil War you can talk to. Why don't you say that really was a series of minor skirmishes and the North blew it up out of proportion because they have economically overwhelmed the South and the South had to go along because they needed aid from the North and they sold the story to the rest of the world and never happened. The United States fooled the world into thinking they put a man on the moon. Hollywood, right? They could do anything. Because it's good for selling American technology. And therefore they did it to sell their products abroad. Do you have more evidence that there were men on the moon than you have of the Holocaust? All the evidence you have is government photos. So what you say to the guy is that internally he has inconsistent standards. Now, if you catch this kind of guy in the right mood, he'll tell you, yeah, but all the evidence for the Holocaust is Jewish evidence. Which it isn't, because the Germans admit it, the Americans admit it. But even if he says that, all you have to do is play the same game one step removed. Ask him, okay, so what evidence do you have that Jewish evidence is unreliable? Let's see the evidence. You say that Jewish evidence is different from other evidence. Let's see the evidence if that's so. And he's going to be caught in the same trap. So, if somebody challenges you, how do you know? And he plays the game. But no matter what reason you give me, it's still possible that you're wrong. One way to respond is to do the philosophical thing that I did. If you're going to use that standard, we don't know anything. Therefore, it's a pointless standard. The other way to respond is to say to him, tell me things that you feel confident of. Tell me things you're satisfied about. Tell me things that you're prepared to agree to and to commit yourself to. Now, I'll come to you, what you said about probability. Without giving it the title, knowledge, and then ask him, why do you think that you have better standards for what you say you believe in than the standards that I have for what I believe in, or better evidence for what you say you believe in than the evidence that I have for what I believe. What you do is you play a comparative game. You don't try to enforce an absolute philosophy. Here's the real standard of knowledge, and I show you that I can live up to the standard of knowledge. Nobody can do that because nobody knows what the standard of knowledge is. When I wrote my Living Up to the Truth, I did my best to avoid philosophical issues altogether. Because if you build your argument on philosophical analysis, you can bet that it's wrong. Because almost all philosophical analyses are wrong. That's why philosophy is still in business. And they'll show it's wrong, and next year they'll do something different.
So like philosophical conclusions cannot be proven just by its nature? By its
well, okay, I'm not talking about that now. Right now, philosophy is in such confusion that nothing is established. So I tried to build my argument by comparison. Now listen, here are standards. These are standards that you accept in other areas of life, so you should accept in these areas of life without trying to state overall principles. At any rate, this then is the way to get around this problem of knowledge. How do you know? To try to compare what you're working with to other things that are clear enough that you're satisfied that you can accept and show that you have similar standards for proposition about the Torah. Now, there's another aspect vis-a-vis the Torah, which is, I think, also crucial. This whole game, how do you know, you have a proof, you know for sure, maybe you're wrong, maybe it's possibly wrong. This whole game is when you're doing armchair philosophy. It doesn't matter one way or the other. You're just playing a game, you know, over beer and pretzels after 10:30 at night. Do you know, don't you know? Take it down to something practical. Something where you have to make a choice. And immediately, the standards change and the seriousness of it changes. And no one is going to even raise the question, but it's still possible you're wrong. You're a doctor and you're in the emergency room. There's been an accident. They bring in the patient and the victim. He's bleeding. He's got broken bones. And there's a bone sticking into his lung. There's been liver damage. And you have to act now! Because if you wait an hour, he's dead. What do? You haven't got time to send out the x-rays over the internet and get, second or third opinions from Sweden and from China. You got to act now. So you look at him, and you take a guess, and you say, I think this is right, and you do it. You don't know that what you're doing is right. But you're not shooting blind either. You're employed to do this because you're good at sizing up complex situations quickly and making reasonable judgments. Which means that you'll be right more often than anybody who's just guessing. And that's why they employ you to make these decisions and perform emergency medicine. No one's going to say, but you could be wrong. Of course I could be wrong. It's only 60-40. I know from experience that I'm wrong 40% of the time. The trouble is other people are wrong 60% of the time. I'm only wrong 40% of the time. That's why they hired me. That's why they employ me. No one under those circumstances can avoid making mistakes. You've got to make a complex judgment with very little evidence. Now, the truth is that when you think about your practical decisions, that's true across the board. You get married, you go into a profession, you buy a house, you choose a place to live. You don't know how it's going to turn out. You can't predict what the consequences will be 5, 10, 15 years down the line. I was in high school when the Russians put up the first satellite. The first satellite around the Earth was put up by the Russians. The Sputnik, 1958. America went into a tizzy. Those backward Russians beat us to space. And they beat us to space. Maybe they can rain bombs down on us too when we're not looking, you know, or even if we are looking. So there was a space race. And the thing was engineers. America needs engineers. And there were special government grants for degrees in engineering, and a lot of bright kids went into engineering. 8 years later, there was a glut of engineers, and a lot of engineers were looking for jobs. What looked like a really surefire thing became oversupplied and didn't work out. Does that mean you make the decision of what profession to go into blind? Just flip a coin, you know, put them all up on the dartboard, close your eyes, throw the dart, and see where it lands? Not at all. It's like investing in the stock market. Stock market goes up, stock market goes down. Still, it's not random. You do the best that you can. There is a science or a discipline called decision theory. Decision theory is about making decisions under uncertainty. That's the name of the subject. When you're subject to uncertainty, you don't know what's going to happen. You only have, as he said, probabilities. How do you make the best decision? So when you're acting, what you do is you gather your evidence and you weigh up the probabilities and you make your choice on that basis. And the fact that you can't prove of a certainty that you're right just doesn't even come up for discussion. Now, when it comes to religion in general, and when it comes to Torah in particular, when you are considering to accept the Torah as true, this is essentially a practical judgment. Because what you're really deciding on is how to live. Of course you're deciding on how to live on the basis of what's true. So does the doctor in the emergency room. He's deciding what therapy to use on the basis of what is true. But how certain does he have to be of what is true? Just, it looks like the best bet. If it looks like the best bet, that's what he does. That's enough to justify his decision. You're a quarterback. You're going back to pass. You have two receivers downfield. They have two defenders who are trying to track them. The line, your front line is collapsing, and they're closing in on you. You can run, throw, or fall on the ball. What do? You've been in this situation hundreds of times before. You make a judgment, an estimate, and you, let's say, choose to throw. If you're a good quarterback and you've got good receivers, a good team, 70% will connect. 30% will not connect. 5% will be intercepted. That's your percentage. You don't know what's going to happen. It doesn't stop you from acting. It doesn't stop you from being successful because you know the percentages and you know which way to get the greatest profit. On any particular occasion, though, you could lose. That's how it is in life. So, of course, when you throw, you're throwing on the grounds that I have a good chance of connecting. You're not just throwing arbitrarily. So the surgery works that way, marriage works that way, profession works that way. When you're asking about reason to accept the Torah as true, at base, what you're asking about is reason to live a Torah life. That's an entirely different standard. That's why I called what I wrote Living Up to the Truth. Because the standard, I believe, should be the standard for making a choice of how to live. Not making a theoretical choice of what to believe. Actually, I'm just inserting a footnote now. I have suspected for a long time, and I was very happy to see in John Searle's new book, Nationality in Action, the very idea that I have been thinking about for many years. And that is that theoretical reason, trying to arrive at truth and falsity, trying to get true beliefs, really is at base a kind of decision how to act. Because you're deciding what to believe and what not to believe. What to accept and what not to accept. And accepting a belief is true is a decision just like deciding to do surgery. At base, matters of true and false for us are matters of what to do. I have no access to ultimately to true and false. I just have all the evidence that's in front of me and my choice what to believe, what not to believe. Choosing what to believe is a species of choosing what to do. So, the idea that there are really two realms, you know, what's true and what to do, and there are different studies with different standards and different kinds of considerations, I think ultimately is not correct. Ultimately, everything is a matter of choice. Choice of what to do. Only sometimes the doing is moving your arms and feet, and sometimes the doing is adopting a belief. At any rate, when it comes to making a choice of how to act, the criterion that we use is probability. Greatest probability of truth. Not absolute certainty. So, when you present a reason, and the critic says you could still be wrong, now you have two things to say. First thing you say is, you're right, I could still be wrong, that's irrelevant. It's irrelevant in even deciding abstractly what's true and false. All the more so, it's irrelevant when we're talking about a decision of how to live. If you want to criticize my reasons, you have to present counter reasons. It's not enough just to dream up possibilities of mistake. You have to present real counter reasons of mistake. And then we can weigh up whether it's my reasons or your reasons are more probable. I'll give you one example of how this works, and then I'll take questions. I have a long, elaborate argument that there's reason to accept there was a revelation at Sinai. Now, one critique that I hear very often is, isn't it possible that they were all hypnotized? I grant you there was an experience and a memory and a belief. But isn't it possible that Moses was a master hypnotist and he just hypnotized all the people to believe it?
That's what they read about Abraham. He was hypnotized when he heard the voice of God.
Abraham?
Well, this is what secular books.
But at any rate,
that he has some
illusion. But that's not hypnosis. I'm talking about hypnosis now. Sorry. I'm not talking about delusion. I'm talking about hypnosis. Hypnosis, where Moses was a hypnotist, and he hypnotized all those people. Isn't it possible? The truth is, I'm not even sure it's possible. But what we ought to say is, let's see some positive evidence that one man could hypnotize tens of thousands of people simultaneously without pills. Let's see some positive evidence that there was hypnosis 3,000 years ago. Is there any reference to hypnosis 3,000 years ago? If there's no reference to the entire process, and we don't have a single case on record where one person hypnotized tens of thousands of people simultaneously, then all the evidence that I have is that such a thing can't happen. I haven't proven it, but certainly all the evidence I have about hypnosis is against this being a case of hypnosis. So I'm weighing up the evidence, and the evidence here is vastly against it being hypnosis. Make the person actually do the job of presenting the evidence for the possibility that he wants you to take seriously. Pointing out that it's possible is not enough. Sure, it's possible, but so what? It's also possible that I'm suffering delusion as to where I live. I don't have to take that seriously. I don't have to take this seriously either. Isn't it possible that with people from outer space? Can you prove that there's nobody in outer space? Maybe I can, but that's not to the point right now. If you're interested in that, there's a wonderful book called Rare Earth, which argues that the probability of intelligent life outside of Earth is extremely small, if not zero. But all right, leave that aside. Is it possible that this visitor is from outer space? Sure it's possible. It's also possible as leprechauns. Right? But is there any positive evidence for visitors from outer space? Any concrete positive evidence? No, then it's a non-starter. It's a non-starter. Doesn't get off the ground. That's how to respond to this kind of critique. Yeah?
Let's say the person doesn't have a counter proposal, but he just wants you to admit that you shouldn't criticize others for other beliefs that you don't have. For instance, we can't deny validity to Christianity or Islam because, after all, we only have 60-40, and there's 40 that are wrong. So the 40 that are wrong gives them validity.
The answer to that is it's just another application of what I've been saying. Let's imagine the worker, the doctor in the emergency room, and the symptoms, the circumstances of the accident are 60% procedure A and 40% procedure B, and he chooses procedure B. What are we going to say to him? Why did you choose B when B is only 40% and A is 60%? So what do you mean? I had 40%. Doesn't that give me validity? Not when there's an alternative with 60%, it doesn't. In practical decisions, you go with the one that has the most probability. One with less probability, you don't go with. Right? The quarterback who decides to fall on the ball every time there's a 30% chance of failure and 70% chance of win isn't going to be a quarterback very long. Because it is with 70-30, you ought to throw. Right? In the long run, he'll do much better with 70-30 throws rather than falling on the ball. So you that's no justification because you had a minority of evidence on the other side.
Yeah. Rabbi, one of the proofs for the existence of God is that every design is out there is a designer. Now, two questions. Is that logical, number one? Question number two, what would a cynic respond to that? How would a cynic respond to that?
The consensus of philosophical thought is the argument for design is not valid. It's complicated in certain ways, but I'll just give you two things to think about briefly. First of all, when they say that if you found a watch, wouldn't you assume that somebody made the watch? The answer is yes, but I suspect that's largely because we know how watches are made. We have lots and lots of experience with watches. Watches, indeed, aren't made by people, and nowadays in factories. So it's not that I would assume it never having seen it. I assume this watch was made because I know how lots of other watches are made. I have lots of positive experience with watches. It doesn't say anything about a frog. where I've never seen how frogs are made. We don't even know how they develop.
You see the design, though.
Oh, you don't see that. What you see is a complex thing which had lots of parts which seemed to work together. The word design begs the question. The question is whether or not, on the basis of this thing's construction, you can infer that it was designed at all, or whether it wasn't designed, and it just took place without any direction. All you can see is that it's a complex thing whose parts work together to keep it going.
That doesn't mean design.
Well, let's see. Let's see whether it does or it doesn't. If the argument is to compare it to a watch, so then I say the reason you take a watch you find on the street and say that somebody designed it is because you know about watches. You have direct experience about this sort of thing. And you know where they come from. They come from people who designed them. You don't have any direct experience of where frogs come from. The other problem is this, that when you infer design on something which you've never seen manufactured before, you only do it so with a certain background. There's a group who put out a couple of books comparing frogs to, I guess there was a film named 2001 or something like that. They went to the moon. I just read this in the book. And they found a slab of metal, a rectangular slab of metal, absolutely smooth, absolutely sharp edges, you know, on the moon. And they said, gosh, that must mean that some intelligent beings visited the moon. Because otherwise, where did this slab come from? Clearly, it's an example of design. And they said, well, if you could say that about a slab of metal on the moon, you've got to be crazy not to say it about frogs. I'm not so sure. How does it go on the moon? Well, what are my alternatives? Either creatures from Alpha Centauri or some other place came there and put it there, or what? Or, nobody came there. Nobody put it there. It just came about naturally. Naturally? How? Well, I think I know everything about what happens on the moon. I think I know everything. What happens on the moon? There are earthquakes, and there probably were volcanic eruptions at one time, and it's hit by meteors, and it's subject to the tidal forces of the sun and the earth, and it's influenced by heat and by cold. I think I know everything about what's going on the moon, and I know that all those forces could not produce a perfectly smooth, exact, rectangular solid of metal. So I say, if you ask me about all the natural forces, they can't do it. Nope. So then it's got to be something else. So I go hunting around for something else, and I ask myself, where in my experience is something like that produced? It's produced by intelligent planners, like we can produce such a slab of metal. So we infer that intelligent planners were there. But that's only because I think I know everything about what goes on the moon naturally without intelligent design.
So the premise is not good.
Correct. But now, when you come to living things, no one thinks that he knows all of the relevant natural forces that are involved in living things. No one thinks he knows that. No one! Not the evolutionist, and not the creationist, and not the neutral, and not the deist. Nobody knows those things, because you're dealing with organic molecules, of which there are millions and millions, and no one has the foggiest idea how they work. And therefore, you get people like Ilya Prigogine and Stuart Kaufman and others who talk about the possibility of self-organizing principles in the universe. When you get molecules that are complicated enough, they self-organize into complex combinations. No one can prove them wrong. Of course, they haven't got much evidence that they're right either, but no one can prove them wrong because we don't have a catalog of all the relevant principles that are apply to living things. So back that being the case, I can't draw the inference that it's designed. What I have to say here is, I don't know what the alternative is. The alternative to design is something spontaneous that gives rise to organization. Now, I'll give you one example, then I've got to go around and teach you the other place. I have 100 small rectangular bars of metal. Little ones. And I have painted each one half red and half blue. I put them into a sack. I shake the sack up and down, and I open up the sack on the table. And it comes out that 60 of them, 30 pairs, are end-to-end red to blue. Now, I claim that I didn't set it up that way. I didn't attach them. It happened randomly. So you say, come on, that's not possible. It's just not possible. I mean, nothing like that happens accidentally. If it had really been random, they would all come out, you know, separated. It can't be. You must have glued them together. You must have pushed them together. You must have ground them together. It can't happen that way accidentally. Now I tell you that they're bar magnets. And the red end is the North Pole. And the blue end is the South Pole. Now, isn't it true that I didn't plan it, I didn't design it, I didn't engineer it, I didn't create it? It happened naturally. Because that's the kind of thing a magnet is. Magnets attract each other naturally, automatically, without any design, without any plan. And yet, 30 pairs come out red to blue. So, if you don't know about magnetism, you would swear up and down that somebody must have put it there that way. Once you know about magnetism, you understand it doesn't have to be somebody there put it there that way. So I think the argument of design misses at least those two points. There are other failures, but the argument that life, because of its complexity, irreducible complexity, according to Michael B., has to be designed is an inference that's very hard to accept. That's two problems with the argument of design. That's why I'm not, you know, thrilled with that argument. And I'm not alone. I mean, the whole of the philosophical world certainly wouldn't accept it.
Don't we have our own argument, Avram?
What's that?
When Avram sees the palace in flames, he says, is it possible the palace lacks an owner? Is that not a similar argument or design?
Nobody knows what Avram's argument was. What you have is that people later generations who are enamored of an argument projected onto Avram. But we have no record where Avram says, here's my reasoning, here are the premises, and here's the conclusion. As far as I know, we have no record of it whatsoever. Yeah, by the way, I think that's the Chumash Lavo, it's not Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva used a woven garment, if I'm not something called the reason. Yeah, but at any rate, the woven garment and the ink, both are subject to the problem that I mentioned. We know where garments are woven. We know where manuscripts are made. We have direct evidence of those kinds of manufacture. We know what produces them. In the case of the world, we have no
doubt. That's why Rabbi Akiva was dealing with an emotional
level. Why was Rabbi Akiva doing that?
He was working on pure logic. He was doing logic and emotion.
I know that's a fundamental, that's a premise of the use when we say that, like, that was one of the things Avram did. So he's saying what? We can't say that? We can't say what Avram did? Avram said, it's a midrash, alright, it's only a midrash, but it said, Avram saw the palace in flames, saw a palace in flames. And it says in the midrash, and he said, is it possible that the palace actually, meaning someone started the flames?